Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcast on allergy myth busting. I'm Dr. Tony Hazel, GP and e-learning fellow at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Professor Adam Fox and we will be trying to do a bit of myth busting in the area of allergy. Adam is a professor in paediatric allergy at Guy's and St Thomas Hospital and the founding director of the KCL Allergy Academy, an award-winning postgraduate educational programme. He was a member of the NICE Guidelines Development Group for the Guideline on Food Allergy in Children and is the current president of the BSACI, the British Society of Allergy and Clinical Immunology. Welcome, Adam, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much for having me along.
So we're going to focus on a few areas in this podcast, and I'd suggest that we start with allergy and vaccination, as of course it's very topical. We're in the middle of the flu vaccination season, and we're also dealing with the COVID-19 vaccinations. I've already had a few calls in the last month or so regarding patients who are concerned about being vaccinated because they're allergic to eggs. Could you explain the background to this?
So I think without a doubt, over the last 20 years, the most common GP query that we get to our allergy departments is about this, about the MMR and the egg allergy. And the reason is that the MMR vaccine is grown on chick fibroblasts. So there is a notional amount of egg in there. And so understandably, if you've got an egg allergy, it doesn't seem like a good idea to inject somebody with something that might contain egg. But as it turns out, the amount of egg is so small that it just never causes reactions, even in the most sensitive egg allergic kids. And in fact, if you look at the little bit of data that's around on this, it turns out that the small number of people who do react to the MMR vaccine, even if they're egg allergic kids, it's other components of the vaccine that they're reacting to. But actually, like other vaccines, significant reactions are very, very rare. For years, there was guidance that said if you had egg allergy, you should have the MMR done under a degree of supervision on the children's ward. But actually, after years of watching these kids troop in and never reacting, we changed the guidance. So the guidance is now very clear. If you're egg allergic, however severe reaction you've had in the past, if you need the MMR, just have it like everybody else at the GP surgery.
That's great. That'll make me a bit more confident next time I get one of those calls. So how does that translate to the flu and the COVID vaccinations? Does anyone need to have those in hospital?
So it does get a little bit more complex because there are other vaccines that do have a little bit of egg in. So, for example, a good example is the yellow fever jab. Not many kids would need that, but that one does need to be done under supervision. With the flu, it's got easier because things have changed in terms of what vaccines are around. So, for example, the standard Fluenz Tetra, which is the nasal vaccine, which is going to be the first line for the overwhelming majority of kids, all those 2 to 15-year-olds that are due to get it this year. It does have a little bit of egg in it, but it's been proven to be safe in kids with egg allergy, with rare exceptions. So and I need to qualify that. So there was a study called the Sniffle study, and this got hundreds of kids who were egg allergic, and they had their Fluenz Tetra given under supervision, and none of them had significant reactions. So therefore, we can generalize and say it's fine for egg allergic kids. But in that study, there weren't any children who had had such severe reactions to egg that they'd landed up on intensive care. So it's felt that we couldn't really generalize to that group. So if you've got a child with egg allergy who's had a really severe reaction in the past, has landed up on ITU, that's really rare because thankfully severe reactions to egg are unusual. Then that should be done with in collaboration with an allergist. I think it's fair to say if one was sent to me, I'd still do them. I'd just do them on the ward under a degree of supervision. But those are really, really rare cases. The overwhelming majority of kids with regular egg allergy, even if they've had a sort of regular anaphylaxis before, should just be done like everybody else. COVID, a little bit more concerned because of the history here. So when the first COVID vaccination were given on the first day, there were two really high profile that made the newspapers, quite significant allergic reactions that gave the impression it was going to be more trouble than it actually turned out to be. It's probably still something in the order of 1 in 150,000 people having their COVID vaccines having significant allergic reactions, so still really rare. But it turns out that things like a history of food allergies or asthma and hay fever, the sort of things you classically associate with allergic kids, aren't risk factors. So those aren't a reason not to have the jab. And in fact, whilst the sort of the key thing to flag up is if they've had a reaction to something that's in the jab, and for the Pfizer, for example, it's something called polyethylene glycol or PEG. That's sort of the main thing that's suspected. But interestingly, it's not turned out to be as straightforward as that. Lots of people who are PEG allergic have turned out to be fine when they've had the vaccine. So it's not a definite exclusion. All I would say is that if you've got a child who's had a reaction to one of the components of the vaccine or a medication that might contain one of the components of the vaccine, because PEG's in a few other medications, just ask for a little bit of help and support. So get in contact with your local allergy service. Again, they will almost certainly do the vaccine, but they might just do it under a degree of supervision. So in fact, from the allergy point of view, other than actually having a significant reaction to the previous jab, there's pretty much no contraindications at all from the allergy side of things.
Thank you very much. So now we're going to move on to the natural progression of allergies. It seems to be a common kind of belief, urban myth, that any allergy will automatically get worse with time. But my experience in practice and with my own allergies is that someone who has a minor reaction the first time will probably carry on having minor reactions in future. What's your take on this concern?
There's a lot of urban myths in allergy that can be the cause of really significant causes of anxiety. And I think for me, the worst is this idea that each time you react, it's going to get worse. I've heard it on TV from media doctors who ought to know better. And of course, what happens in practice is anyone who's had a sort of moderate reaction is convinced the next one will definitely kill them. And so you can imagine the amount of anxiety that that's going to cause. In fact, and I guess if you reflect on this quite predictably, how bad any reaction is going to be, it's going to depend on a number of variables. It's going to depend on how much of the food you eat, how what your state of health is on the day. So, for example, we strongly suspect that if you've got poorly controlled asthma and that's troubling you at the time, that's going to make you more likely to have a bad reaction. If you've got a viral infection, that will make you more sensitive, so you'll react to a smaller amount and more likely to have a severe reaction. If you've got alcohol in your system, if you've been exercising, there's a range of things that are what we call cofactors that will influence the severity of any reaction. And in fact, what happened last time isn't really one of those at all. It's not really relevant. I think it's fair to say that most reactions are mild. It's fair to say that most very severe reactions, as a consequence, happen in people who have only ever had mild reactions. So they will often sort of refer to the fact that, you know, I can't believe I had a bad reaction. I only had a mild peanut allergy. What they mean is their previous reactions have been mild. The bottom line is that allergic reactions are inherently unpredictable. You are more likely to have a bad one if you've had a bad one before. You are more likely to have a bad one if you've got poorly controlled asthma. But at the end of the day, the reactions are unpredictable. And that's what makes food allergy really challenging to manage. Really severe reactions are rare, but you just don't know who they're going to affect. So everybody in their own mind has to be sort of prepared for that possibility. But it's always important to get that risk in context as well. So one thing I'm always very clear with my patients, it doesn't get worse each time. Each reaction is unpredictable.
Thanks. That's really useful to know when I'm talking to patients and to their parents. So to move on to our final topic, we're going to discuss adrenaline auto-injectors, or AAIs. And there's currently two brands available in the UK, EpiPen and Jex. And it does thankfully seem like those supply issues of the last few years are resolving. I find lots of children with an AAI on repeat and no really clear reason why they need it. Is that an issue which comes up in your clinical practice?
It's a real bugbear of mine. It's an enormous issue. And sadly, I think what's happened, and you know, you look at the numbers of pens that have been prescribed, it has gone up enormously over the last 20 years or so, quite dramatically. And I once remember one of the manufacturers telling me that there was something in the order of about 80 people carrying adrenaline in the UK in the 1980s. That was it. There's now over 370,000 people carrying adrenaline. And interestingly, over that time period, well, we've seen this enormous increase in carrying of adrenaline. In fact, per patient, they're carrying more of them as well. There's actually not been an increase in the number of anaphylaxis fatalities. Of course, each one is an absolute tragedy, but the numbers have remained stable, something between 10 and 20 each year in the UK. If you then look at what's happening in terms of how common it is to have a severe reaction, that has been going up quite significantly. And there's really good data from A&E departments, for example, showing a marked increase in the number of severe reactions happening, but still no increase in fatalities. So there's evidence that the case fatality rate is actually coming down. So given that there's so many more people having bad reactions, it's very much driven by kids with food allergies. This isn't a big epidemic of adults having allergic reactions to medications or antibiotics. This is being driven by what appears to be an underlying increase in the number of reactions in kids to food. But we're not seeing a big epidemic of fatalities. And of course, we know the overwhelming majority of EpiPens go into cupboards. People aren't properly trained how to use them. So even if they're carrying them around, they often don't know how to use them when they need to. This comes up recurrently at inquests, that people haven't been trained properly on the adrenaline on the adrenaline devices, or they don't have them with them, or they're out of date, etc. And I can't help but feel that this is part of the fact that of overprescribing, that we're completely diluting out the kids who are really high risk, that we should be very focused on the ones who have had a history of severe reactions, the ones who have got poorly controlled asthma, who we know are more at risk. If we could really focus on them and separate these guys out, that would be much, much better. Make sure that they are definitely trained how to use them, carrying them, understand exactly when and how to use them, etc., rather than just prescribing them to absolutely everybody who's got a food allergy, because that's to a degree what's happening. And it's horrible to say, but it's probably a little bit lazy, because it's easier to just prescribe the EpiPen than actually have a proper conversation with the patient about risk assessment, what the real underlying risk is, the fact that, you know, a child who's got an egg allergy, for example, that's the most common food allergy we see, that their risk of fatality is incredibly small, and significantly less likely than that child being, you know, that being morbid, being murdered, dying in a fire, being killed in a car accident. Those are dramatically more likely to happen than them dying of their food allergy, even if they have, or they're the kids with the food allergies. But it requires a conversation to get all of that into the context. Parents feel a lot better for it, and often they're very happy to then not be prescribed the EpiPens. So I guess if we sort of go back to first principles, who should be carrying? Well, there is national guidance out from the British Society, BSACI. It's on their website. There's just been a primary care update for that. And it's pretty clear. If you've got a food allergy and you've had a severe reaction in the past, like you've had anaphylaxis, you've had the sort of reaction that you would have used that EpiPen for, then you should be carrying them. If you've got a food allergy and you have asthma, then that's a big risk factor. You should be carrying EpiPen. So those are both pretty non-negotiable. And then we've got a load of relative indications. So if you live a long way from medical help, if you, you know, live in a farmhouse in Norfolk somewhere, and you know that the ambulance is going to take a long time to get you, it just makes a bit more sense that you've got the definitive treatment with you. If you're going on exotic travels where you can have no chance of getting medical support because you're trekking up the Amazon, if you've got a nut allergy, if you're a teenager, both of those do increase the risk of you having bad reactions. So it needs a conversation and risk assessment with the parents. What I think is really important is to get past this idea that families and patients will feel better because they've got an EpiPen or a Jext because they've got one of these pens. That's an enormous assumption. And although there's not much data on this, the little bit that there is, it's pretty clear that actually prescribing and adding one of these to the emergency plan decreases the quality of life of that family. So it gives them something else to worry about. It increases anxiety. You can only imagine every time families go on a play date that you're essentially handing over the child with their adrenaline pen and giving the impression that if this child is given the wrong food to eat, they're going to die. And that's a gross misrepresentation of the actual risk. So again, it comes back to proper education, getting the risk in context, discussing risk with the families. And that's difficult to do. And that's why I'd be really keen for anyone listening to this, if they're interested, this situation comes up, have a look at that primary care guidance around prescribing these adrenaline pens from the BSACI on the BSACI.org website, because I think you'll be able to not only reduce your prescribing, but more importantly, have happy patients who feel more comfortable not having these pens, which is really the situation that we want to be in. And that those who do need them really do know how to use them, know when to use them, are committed to carrying with them, know how to carry out risk assessments, and are going to, you know, when the chips are down, are actually going to use it. That's really what we're after.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree about the sort of medicalizing of people, of children unnecessarily and causing anxiety. So for those children who do need to carry an AAI, there's sometimes a bit of tension about how many to prescribe. I get that anyone who needs one should have two because you might need a second dose, but we sometimes get requests for 8 or 10, two to go at mum's, two at dad's, two at grandma's, two at school, two to go to swimming training. How many should we be prescribing?
So this causes an enormous amount of contention on lots of levels. So you're absolutely right about carrying two. The MHRA is absolutely clear in their regulatory guidance, and the BSACI guidance to primary care supports that. Essentially saying, well, it's a sobering number. It's 20% of kids who need the first one need a second one. So you certainly wouldn't want to be caught short. And it's only 5 minutes from giving the first to when you're going to be giving the second. So it's wholly plausible that the ambulance won't quite be there yet. So our instruction to the patients is always have access to two at all times. Within the more specialist BSACI guidance, it sort of gives clinicians more scope for using their own clinical judgment about how many are carried. And I think that's because really what they're trying to say is there's some people who we probably feel don't really need to be carrying them, but giving them one is then, you know, because of a sort of bit of a trade-off can be appropriate. But that needs to be somebody who's very comfortable in managing this sort of area. So the default should be two if you're giving them. And then the question is around sort of school and home. So there's been, and I think this was an enormous advance 3 or 4 years ago, change in the legislation, which allows schools to keep their own generic pens, which means that if anybody there has an allergic reaction, then they can potentially use their pen if the child doesn't have their own pen or there isn't one available. But it was very clear from speaking to parents that they didn't want that to be a replacement for the child's own pens, because I think they then feel that they're sort of really reliant on the school getting this right, as opposed to them being able to say, look, here are the kids' two pens, make sure they're always available. So each child will need two that stay in school, and we normally recommend that that's it, they stay there. Don't try to take them backwards and forwards every day, because that's sort of asking for them to get lost. But then there's another set, so we're now talking about two sets of two, the other set that simply go round everywhere else the child goes. I know lots of families will push for all these additional sets, but I think that, you know, the implication is if there's two at grandma's and two at home and two at somebody else's, then why aren't they carrying the two that are with, you know, their two with them to grandma's house? That's what they should be doing. Otherwise, that there's a period of time where they don't have them. So I think can push back to families and say, reasonable, two for school, two for everywhere else. I don't have an enormous issue. You know, for example, some patients will find, you know, find private GPs or private doctors and get additional ones. I don't have an issue with that, as long as you sort of have the chat about, you know, that they still need them when they're carrying, you know, when they're going from one place to the other. So there shouldn't really be a need.
So finally, I'm sure you get as frustrated as I do when a parent comes in with a result of an allergy test that they bought online and they clearly wasted their money on something with no real clinical validity. Can you elaborate a bit on what is available online and why they aren't generally useful?
Sure. I mean, you can broadly divide these into two types of tests. So there's the things that are essentially, for want of a nicer word, just quackery. So vagal testing, kinesiology, stuff you can get online. And the classic online one is an IgG test. Now, because often the labs are measuring IgG levels accurately and reliably, they can get lab accreditation, and that will give it a sheen of sort of respectability. Of course, the bit that's missing is, what does the IgG level actually mean? And what a lot of the online sites will claim is that they're measures of food intolerance. There are plenty of learned societies and NICE included who are very clear that these tests don't have a role, certainly not in allergy diagnosis. And I've certainly never seen anything compelling to tell me that they should have a role in intolerance diagnosis either. The truth is that diagnosing intolerance is hard. You just have to do the hard work of the exclusions and the reintroductions to get to the bottom of it. And of course, the idea of a blood test that says, yes, you're intolerant to this and no, you're not intolerant to that is very, very attractive. I can understand why people want to do these tests, but there's just not the science to support them being useful. So that's sort of easy on one level. They just don't have a place in clinical practice. But then the other tests are the IgE tests, which are the tests that we use as clinicians, but you can also just get them yourself online. And the problem there is that these tests are completely unhelpful without clear clinical context. A screening test just in isolation, they will lead to massive overdiagnosis, because lots of people, especially kids who have got a background with things like eczema, will have raised levels of allergic antibody of IgE to a whole raft of different things that they're absolutely fine with and will actually be demonstrably fine with, because they'll be eating them and have no problem whatsoever. But the temptation is to see a slightly raised IgE, not recognize that this is exclusively a test for immediate type allergy and that actually you've got the diagnosis because you can eat that food without having a reaction. And instead think, oh, maybe that food is contributing to making the child's eczema worse, or it's giving them a runny nose, or giving them some sort of allergic symptom. And we see this, unfortunately, all the time in clinical practice of these tests being overinterpreted. So essentially, they're not screening tests. They're just no good for that. They just give you loads of false positives. But they're enormously helpful when they're used in a clear clinical context, focused on immediate type reactions in order to get diagnoses. But that's how they need to be used. And that just doesn't happen when they're bought offline or you know, with a quick questionnaire filled in. So I think the sort of, you know, the quick and easy answer to what you said is just don't do these online tests. If you think you've got immediate allergies, speak to your GP or a doctor who's got a bit of experience at dealing with this, and make sure that the tests are done in the clinical context of your symptoms.
Thank you. So I think that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to say a huge thank you to Professor Adam Fox for answering my questions and trying to bust some allergy myths. Thank you very much for listening to this RCGP podcast. If you enjoyed it, please look at some of our other podcasts on the RCGP e-learning podcast channel.